Good afternoon. Let's start. Welcome to the second last week of term. Today's topic, as you can see, has to do with conversation and the structure of conversation and the analysis of conversation. And in fact, we're going to concentrate a lot on the analysis of spontaneous dialogue, conversation between several people. There is a handout coming round, which is one sheet with sort of two sides, one sheet of paper where there is a conversation on that I will be playing recording of. Okay. I made 80 copies. I guess that should be enough. If not, then you need to sit next to someone who's got a copy. It's just so that you can follow it in a sort of more easy way. For those of you who are listening, not here in the lecture theatre, but at home, there is a PDF which I'll make available as well of that conversation. Okay, so you need to download that first. Okay, as usual, a few bits of admin, and this is also the time for the handout to go around. First of all, I've now also, you were invited to give feedback. I've now received that feedback from the official, through the official channels. If there's interest, I can upload it to the StudIP page. It was quite interesting in some respects to read for me. Like last year, if I remember correctly, the number of people who said that they were interested in the field dropped from the beginning of the lecture to the time when you were asked to fill in the questionnaire. There are two possible interpretations. Number one, I'm doing a bad job. Number two, a lot of people have realized, oh, it's something completely different from what I expected. I'm not quite sure yet how I should interpret this. Quite a few additional comments were interesting. One of you suggested that I should block off the last eight rows completely. Might be a good idea. Not this term, maybe next term, etc. So, is there a general... do you want to see this or do you not care? Shall I upload it?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll do that. Okay, good. I'll also upload the results of the second assignment. I'll upload it in the form of your matricule number and the grade, the mark that you would have received if that had been the exam. Okay? So that should give you an idea, if you've done it without looking at the sources, where you stand. Okay? You'll also be able to pick it up from my secretary's office if you want to look at it in detail, but the important information will also be simply online. Okay? I've now received whatever you submitted. If you didn't submit it and you are a BA student, you're in trouble and you need to come and contact me as soon as possible. Okay? I will also, and that's something that I did the last 2 years with varying success, not necessarily because of what we did, but the technical restrictions. As you know that there is, there is a chat opportunity or some kind of chat client built into StudIP. And what I've offered in the past was sort of a particular time slot where people could log on and then I would try to answer questions, closer to the exams date. So I could do that again if there is interest. Not many people here now from the overall group of people. Is there interest for this in this group? Can you raise your hands if that? Yeah, okay, enough people put, yeah, okay. Yes, okay, I'll send this round by email. I'm not quite sure yet when it's going to happen, sometime in the term break, at a time that I'm sure is not going to be convenient for everybody, but what I did in the past then was to upload the transcript so that everyone could read what we were discussing. It's actually going to be quite chaotic. Well, not chaotic, but it's difficult because when there are sort of 36 people online and they all ask questions and I just Yeah. So I'll have to find a way. Last time it worked better than the first year, where I sort of assign the floor to one particular person. So I assign something that we're going to talk about today, the right to speak to one, or to write, to one particular user, and then I'll try to answer that question. The point I'll make today is that this is not a very natural way of organizing conversation, of course. You don't usually arrange in advance who is going to speak next. Okay. But in a situation like that, we need to do this, and you need to cooperate then. Okay. One of the problems is that the chat client seems to chuck people out after a time if you're just sort of leeching or checking what other people are asking, etc. So maybe I find a better solution. I don't know yet. I'll see. Okay. I'll also upload the solutions to the exercises which I've been distributing for almost every lecture this term, later in the term break, to encourage you to do it without looking at the solutions. But if you don't want to do this, but just look at the solutions, then that's your choice as well. Okay. Any other? Oh, yeah. Okay. If you haven't signed up for the exam yet, you need to sign up for the exam. Okay? You need to go on LSF and you need to find the appropriate exam. There should really be only a limited number of exams visible. I know that there are one or two people in the audience who actually see exams that they shouldn't be seeing. I've been trying to understand why, but I haven't been able to find out. In any case, you need to sign up for the exam on LSF, and if you don't and just turn up on the day of the exam, we're not allowed to, and we won't let you into the room. So please make sure you sign up. The sign-up period finishes 4 weeks before the exam. Okay, so that's not tomorrow, but it's going to be soonish. So why not just sign up now? Okay? Yes? I was going to bring it along, I managed to forget. No. Okay. Does anyone have the number? Okay. I don't know. You have a number? Okay. Well, I think it's probably better if I send it round, because there are different numbers for different degree schemes. Yeah. So let's just, or also, if you're having trouble signing up and you think that something is wrong, I mean, your first call, I guess, would be the Hochschulprüfungsamt, but if you're terribly confused and you think that I can help, you can also write me an email. Okay. Has anyone not managed to sign up, but wanted to? No, okay, yes.
How long will the lectures be uploaded to Constellation? Or is there no deadline?
There's no deadline, no. It'll just be there, yes. In fact, the ones from last year are still available as well for the people who are redoing it. So I'm not deleting them. They'll be there for a while. Okay. Okay. Shall we do some linguistics then? Yay. Okay. Good. That's the spirit. Yes. Good. Let's start with this one then. Yeah. Okay. A bit of Calvin and Hobbes. This is about conversation and discourse analysis. When a person pauses in mid-sentence to choose a word, that's the best time to jump in and change the subject. It's like an interception in football. You grab the other guy's idea and run the opposite way with it. The more sentences you complete, the higher your score. The idea is to block the other guy's thoughts and express your own. That's how you win. And then Hobbes says, conversations aren't contests. And Calvin says, okay, point for you, but I'm still ahead. Yeah. So, we will be looking today at conversations, how they are organized, to what extent they may actually perhaps be a little bit like a contest, but basically how they work. How is it possible for us to not have a script and still usually not really talk at the same time? Yeah. Now, before I play that extract to you, I would like to introduce something very briefly, and this is not a distinction that is very important, so it's not something that you need to know by heart or anything for the exam, but I wanted to make the point anyway. that sometimes in the literature you find both conversation analysis and discourse analysis, and sometimes these terms are interchanged or are used interchangeably, but sometimes some people want to make a difference. So I thought I'd give you the two traditional views before actually starting to talk about what's going on in conversation. If we're looking at traditional discourse analysis, then we're basically doing what we've been doing so far, namely looking at structure of sentences, but we're in a way expanding it to what's beyond the sentence. So we're looking at techniques used for linguistic analysis of sentences that are extended over. Not, they're not looking at the techniques. They're using this as in the same way as we've done it for sentences, but we're extending it over the sentence boundary. So basically, the discourse is a string of sentences. Now, these people typically work with intuition-based approach, with an analysis of data that they sometimes actually came up with themselves, invented, constructed by the analyst. And the basic unit of this is the speech act. We talked about speech acts, we talked about indirect speech acts, pragmatics, etc. So in the same way as, let's say, words and phrases and clauses make up a sentence, they think that speech acts make up a conversation. And they distinguish between what's well-formed and what's ill-formed in the same way as you can say something is grammatical and something is not grammatical. Okay, that's sort of the traditional discourse analytical approach. The conversation analysis would go at things rather differently. They would take a much more empirical approach, meaning they look at lots of data, lots of authentic data of conversations that were actually happening between people, between real people, because they believe that intuition is unreliable. This is an approach which I will again mention a lot next week when I'll be talking about corpus linguistics, because again, there we think that looking at language by looking at what you think about language is not the best way to go about it. These people who are conversation analysts, the traditional conversation analysts, look at systematic properties of, and this term will become more clear in a minute, sequential organization of talk. Okay, so what happens after each other, or what happens in sequence? Just to give you an example, can you decide whether this is well-formed or ill-formed? A says, I have a 14-year-old son. B says, well, that's all right. A says, I also have a dog. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that ill-formed? Well, in a way, yes. I mean, can you make sense of this? I think it's very easy to make sense of this if you know the right context. Okay. Think of a situation where you're going to an apartment that you would like to rent, and you meet the landlord, and you tell that person, well, I have a son. Well, that's okay. I've got nothing against kids. I have a dog. I'm sorry. No pets allowed. And suddenly the whole thing makes perfect sense. So it's really quite... If you're only looking at these individual utterances as part of something that is ill-formed or not, then you're missing the point that you need much more than that in order to make sense of this. So today, as I said, these terms are often used interchangeably. Today, a lot of people are working with the approach that we need to look at real data, at authentic data, and we're looking at sort of an empirical way of making sense of patterns that happen again and again. Okay. And in fact, many of the things that we're looking at today are things that happen very regularly in the conversation, in everyday conversation. Right. I've already said that today we're looking at mostly spontaneous conversation. And in this connection, I've already mentioned briefly during the admin session of that lecture that it's really quite surprising, I think, that even though there is no script, it's not like a theater play where people know exactly when they're due to talk. But although there's no script, we don't really overlap all that much. We know when who is allowed to speak. But the question really is then, how do we know when to stop? Why do you not just go on? Okay, some people talk more than others. Yeah. But even so, usually when that person stops or when another person starts, it's hardly ever the case that that person just keeps on rambling. There seems to be some sort of organization. Yeah. It's not an anything goes situation. And it's also not a situation which is purely a contest where people grab each other's right to speak. There is a lot of cooperation going on. And if you listen to a conversation amongst your friends, perhaps when you go out after the lecture, start to listen to the fact that it's quite interesting, usually, that when one person stops, see whether there's a break, whether there is a pause, whether there is a minimal overlap, etc. The kind of things that we're going to talk about today. Now, of course, some situations are more regulated than others. We are currently in a highly regulated context. I have the right to talk, you don't. Okay? Although there have been some issues with this, but that's basically the idea. I'm supposed to be here, and it's a one-way interaction. Okay? I welcome interruption. But then in order to interrupt me, you usually put up your hands, and I then need to assign the right to speak to you. Okay? That's a fairly unusual situation. I mean, it's not unusual in this context, but that's not how most conversation is happening. In fact, there are even more restricted or more rule-governed situations, for example, and I think that's also in the reading for today in Finnegan, that when during a meeting you're allowed to speak in some countries or in some cultures depends really on your social rank within that that society. So clearly there are contexts where things are very regulated, but we are really talking about spontaneous conversation today. Okay, and that gives me now an opportunity to play the extract. I'll play it once. And I'd just like you to listen to this and get an impression of what's going on. It's a conversation, as it says on the handout, between two couples. They've been on holiday, well, one of the two couples, and they tell each other what's happened. They're having basically a friendly dinner table conversation. Very natural. They were recorded. They probably, by that stage, were not really aware of the fact that they're being recorded anymore. Okay. Just listen to it. I will then again play it towards the end of the lecture, and then maybe you can try to find all the features that I'll be talking about during the lecture.
And so, channel crossing.
Sorry.
So in 20 hours, with the nightclub, we had a super cabin which was just below the nightclub. Utterly soundproof. You know, when you think what ours is like. Mm-hmm. When we shut our cabin door, even though there was anything outside, it was a nightclub, Pando Music Room, mm-hmm. Just one, immediately overhead, and we were the cabin next to it. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't hear it at all. Mm-hmm. And of course, we could say to the children, we'd just be upstairs, and they knew they'd just have to put their dressing gown on and come up and say, I'm upstairs. So that was super.
Wait, did you have a car with you?
Mm-hmm. It's not included in the price,
yes, you?
Oh,
how did you get, I mean, how did you find that side of it? Because. You know, some people say that the driving a car across a ferry isn't that good a job.
Well, this was
are you taking a car across to the continent?
No,
on a ferry, it is hell.
No, it isn't at all.
I don't know. But
I mean, that's not the channel. Is that really
yeah, a ferry across the
channel?
It's not.
So what's the driver?
Well,
you try to get on, you get out, you take one block, you lock the car, you go to, well, if you want to, if you've got a cabin, if it's a night, this crossing, you automatically have a cabin. But on the cross channel ones you don't. But if it's a day one you can have a day time, you want to make a couple of hours. Mm. And it's probably worth it for kids. Mm. And you just have to get up
all
the
way around. Well, I'll tell you a little thing, I mean, every summer you see stories of tremendous queues.
Then you've got a book.
Yeah. I keep going.
Mind you, last summer was the weekend where the queues were so bad that even people were booked.
And it was something during the strike,
though, wasn't it? Yeah, there was some trouble with the road.
But certainly, in the past, we've just grown child has been ill, so they've stopped somewhere and they've missed their booking, and those people have to wait for a vacancy. In the years we've been, they've got on usually. There haven't been masses of people waiting to get on. But when the year that we did break down, we were actually put back across from Bulan or Calais or somewhere, and we just drove out and got onto the boat.
Okay. Four people having a friendly chat over dinner. In some way chaotic, I guess. I mean, there's a lot going on, yeah? But very ordered in many other ways, I think. Okay. There is hardly any competition for the floor. There is one, I think, one particular scene where she wants to take over and says, but certainly, but etc. So we could say that this is some kind of contest, but very often it just seems to run seamlessly from one speaker to the next. Okay. So some observations. And some of these observations are extremely basic. Okay. Some of the things I'm going to say now are just sort of so basic that it's almost ridiculous to mention them. But let's look at this anyway. Speaker change occurs. Yes, of course, it's a conversation. And in fact, it recurs. It just happens again and again, not chaotically, but in a fairly ordered fashion. Usually there's only one person speaking. There may be instances where another person says something during one person's turn, but then very often these are just sort of little, not even full utterances, things like, yeah, or yes, or something like that. These are called back channels. They basically signal that, yes, I'm with you, I'm listening to you. And notice next time when I play this at the end of the lecture, very often they actually happen exactly during pauses, not really true pauses, but sort of at the end of an intonation unit during the speaker's turn. So even that seems to be very well coordinated in some way. Again, a very trivial fact, but worth noticing, it's the turn size itself, how much one speaker says, is variable. Yes, of course. Some of these turns are actually quite long. It's half a page on where someone is just telling a story. Okay. And of course, we also don't have the length of conversation. We don't know where it stops, okay. When it stops. Okay. At some stage, they will have talked enough, and then one couple will go home. Okay. But this is to be negotiated between them. Okay. And of course, the content isn't specified in advance, which means that we need to introduce new topics, we need to negotiate again between the different speakers. Now, as I said, these are very trivial observations, but they are nevertheless, if you think about it, in a way a little bit puzzling, because the question is, how does it work? Now, this is what some people in the early 70s have been asking themselves, and they came up with, that's the title of their very influential paper, A Simplest Systematics for the Organization of Turn-Taking for Conversation, okay. In a journal called Language, which is a very, very prestigious journal. Okay. And they described the obvious in some way, but they described it to make the point that it is an ordered system. And they came up with these turn-taking rules, and I'd like to run through them quickly. Again, I'd like to make the point that these are in a way very basic observations, but still. The turn-taking rules are such that, number 1A, the current speaker may select, that is, choose, who will be the next speaker. I'll give you examples of all these afterwards. So I, as a speaker, may select who's the next speaker, and therefore I stop and the other person starts. If the current speaker does not select the next speaker, a next speaker may self-select. This could be because I've stopped talking, and we don't like silence. Okay? We don't like awkward silence. Try to drive in a car with someone you don't really know. Someone's given you a lift. You feel the need to talk. It's odd to just sit there, because that may be misinterpreted, right? Yeah. So we seem to have this need to well, if at least not asked to be talked, then we feel that we have the floor and we need to fill it, we need to say something, otherwise perhaps it's impolite or may be misinterpreted. If no other participant self-selects as next speaker, then the current speaker may, but need not, continue speaking. Okay. Very simple rules, and these are sort of cyclical in the sense that they continue to apply at every possible, and that's a term that you need to learn, transition relevance place, until speaker transfer occurs. That's usually abbreviated as TRP. Now, what exactly a TRP is not easy to define. But it seems to be something which, for various reasons, signals to the other person, if you want, you could start talking now. If you don't, I will just continue, probably. Yeah? Or we'll have an awkward piece of silence, moment of silence. So let me just give you a couple of examples to make sure everyone understands what I mean. First one, 1A, can you tell me the time, John? I even mention my conversational counterpart's name. Well, the milkman has come. Okay? Example from the pragmatics lecture. Okay. So we've got the first speaker selecting explicitly the second speaker. If the current speaker does not select next speaker, next speaker may self-select. I bought a new car yesterday. Oh, did you? What color is it? Now, you could actually debate whether a person hasn't been selected here. In a way, probably there is some sort of signal that A has stopped. Now, we look at those signals later on, but there is no explicit, I hereby finish my turn, it is now your turn. Okay, but it's just basically because one person has stopped. Or we might have a situation where person A says, I bought a new car yesterday, we have an awkward piece of bit of silence, perhaps, or just nothing happens. It may not even be awkward. Well, the old one was about to die. Okay. But how do we really know? How do we detect this transition relevance place? Now, obviously, the meaning, obviously, what I'm saying has an important factor, is an important aspect of that. Is my contribution complete? But it doesn't actually always mean that I have to have completed what I wanted to say. Sometimes I may not even know what I want to say, and I sort of my talk just peters off. And there may be then, therefore, other reasons to decide, yeah, there is a transition relevance place. For example, my intonation contour may have finished. The way I lower my voice, the way I slow up in the pace of my talking. I'm also perhaps using extra linguistic features like eye contact or body posture or whatever, even some kind of gestures like it's your turn now, of course. Now that all contributes to our ability to know where a transition relevance place is. But there is really one very important way of organizing conversation, which is quite fundamental, and that's termed a adjacency pair. Okay. An adjacency pair is a pair of utterances that are, well, obviously adjacent, meaning they are next to each other, and they are of this type. How old are you? 21. What kind of pair is this? This is a question-answer pair. Okay. And there are many just very common pairs of this type. A greeting is typically paired with a greeting that's sort of the response. If you announce something, then you get a receipt, the announcement has been received. These are sometimes called typed pairs. They are just typical, they are very common, they are a regularity in the turn-taking system. This also means that if someone asks a question, or if someone performs a particular speech act, for example, a request or something like that, or just asking a question, then this is the first part of an adjacency pair. And you really need to complete this, and the conversational partner is expected to do this, with the second part of the adjacency pair. It doesn't always necessarily have to be adjacent. We might have a situation like this. This is in the United States, where you're not allowed to drink or buy alcohol below the age of 21. At least I think in most states, I can't remember. Can I have a bottle of scotch, please? Are you 21? Is this an adjacency pair? Not really, because that's not the expected response. It's a question. So, no. Okay. Is there an adjacency pair? Yes, there is an adjacency pair from are you 21? No. Okay. And then, as a result of this adjacency pair, we then get the response to the first part of the outer adjacency pair, so to speak, namely, sorry, in that case, I can't give you any bottle of scotch. So this is an insertion sequence where the first part makes you expect a second part, but it cannot be immediately given because there is some necessary information missing. Therefore, it isn't responded to as it would be expected, but rather we're opening in another first part of an adjacency pair. Once that's fulfilled, the response to the very first one can be given. But all of this is on the assumption that there is a first part and there is a second part. And if there is no second part, then there must be a good reason for this. This is something that illustrates this to some point. Do you want to taste the potatoes? This might be husband and wife. And husband says, this is a really interesting article about racism in the police force. They're saying there's got to be a massive education campaign to change the way people think. Is that the second part of an adjacency pair? Not really. In fact, we could interpret this in the context of speech act theory. Someone's flouting the maxim of manner, saying much too much, etc. This may mean that the husband actually doesn't really want to, and in that sense, it may actually be, to some extent, the second part of an adjacency pair. Okay, but it doesn't look like it on the surface. Wife says there certainly has. Yeah. Potatoes? Fork. Okay. So, in a way, you can perhaps see how this conversation relies on the fact that one bit has to be filled or asks for a second part. Maybe this is not the best example, and therefore I thought I'd give you one which is even more, even longer, but which completely relies on this organization into adjacency pairs. This is a phone conversation. Okay. I ordered some paint from you a couple of weeks ago, some vermilion. New. And I wanted to order some more. The name's Boyd. The person in the shop says, yes. How many tubes would you like, sir? What's the price now with VAT, do you know? Shop person says, oh, I'll just work that out for you. Thanks. Then we've got a 10-second break. £3.19 a tube, sir. £3.19, is it? Yeah. Yes. That's £3.19. That's for the large tube, isn't it? Well, yeah, it's the 37 CCS. I'll tell you what, I'll just ring you back. I have to work out how many I'll need. Sorry, I wasn't sure of the price, you see. Okay. Now, can you see where we might have at the beginning of an adjacency pair and then the second part? I'll work this out for you. And I wanted to order some more. The name's Boyd. That's, in a way, a request. Or sort of some statement. How many would you like to have? Or would you like to buy? That is a question. And it's the first part of a question. We would expect a response to this. Okay? Do we get a response to this? Can the last row please stop chatting? It's beginning to bother me. Thank you. Okay. Do we get a response to the first question? Well, no, we get a second question. Because, well, the speaker can't answer the question yet, therefore we have some sort of insertion sequence. That then results in, well, the person saying, wait a minute, this is accepted by the other speaker, by the person who's calling. And then we get an answer, but we get the answer to the second question and not the first. The first question is still somewhere in the air. It's not responded to. In fact, that then leads to a third question, which gets immediate response. That is an adjacency query. What do we get after this? A fourth question. And an immediate response. So you can see how the individual parts are actually always first part of an adjacency pair, second part of an adjacency pair. But the first question still hasn't been answered to or responded to. Do we get a response that takes account of this? Yes. Do we get a response that answers the question? No, but we need to have some account for the fact that the answer is not given, because that is still somewhere in the air in the conversation. That adjacency pair has not been filled or has not been completed yet. Now, I don't know whether this is terribly obvious or not, and I think in a way it's very basic, but we can see that this conversation basically goes on for quite a while because of the first question that's still not responded, and we have various that's been not responded to, and we have various insertion sequences, so to speak. Okay? So adjacency pairs are fundamental. Right, I'll now go through a couple of other features of conversation that have an impact on the sequence and on how, on the sequence of utterances and how they are produced and interpreted. Now, if we have an adjacency pair, we have a first part, as we've just seen, and we then may have a response that is actually not what the first person, what the first speaker wants. If I ask you for something, then I would like you to give it to me. Obviously, if you don't want to give it to me, then that's a dispreferred response. So, or it could be a preferred response in the sense of, yeah, sure, here it is. So if the child says, I have to admit this is a rather unusual or odd example, could you put out the light for my room? Usually it's the other way around. And the father says, sure, then that's an adjacency pair, a request, and the acceptance of that request, and basically the sort of perlocution, one could say, the fact that then the father switches off the light. But look at this. I wonder whether there is any chance of seeing you tomorrow sometime, morning or before the seminar. I doubt it. The reason is I'm seeing Elizabeth. Now this is clearly a dispreferred response. What speaker C wants is, yeah, sure, come and see me at 10 o'clock. So it's something that is also a face threat. If you think back to the politeness lecture last week, basically I am threatening the positive face of my conversational partner here. I'm making him feel less liked in a way. Okay? So in order to do this, I as a speaker, if I offer a dispreferred response, I may take care of this in some way. And this may have an impact on how I realize the dispreferred response. Notice, by the way, this is a pause of 1 second. Whose pause is this? The way I've done it here, it's the pause of the speaker C. But really, if you think about it, that's not true. It's the pause, it takes a bit longer for speaker R to speak, and that is already interpreted by speaker C as a signal that there might be a dispreferred response. We also have some hesitation devices here, I doubt it. Mm-hmm. The reason is I'm seeing Elizabeth. So there are formal signs that show that this is likely going to be a dispreferred response. You might get pauses, you might get prefaces like, well, that sounds nice, but, okay. Now again, that sounds nice, but if you think about it from the politeness point of view, you're first taking care of the person's positive face. It sounds really nice, but unfortunately I can't. Okay. Explanations of why not, and really then only do we get the actual sort of fact that I can't take care of what you would like me to. Okay. Give you another example. Do you want to come out to the pub tonight? Well, thanks, but I have to wash my hair tonight, so no, I can't make it tonight. Okay? All right. This is, I'm quite sure, a constructed example. Yeah? And I said at the beginning, conversation analysts typically work with large amounts of authentic data. Yes, okay, I'm making things up here in order to show the typical ways that have been analyzed in language, but I guess you get the point. Okay. Here, I've now put the 2-second pause into the turn of speaker B, because that pause is part of the dispreferred response. And I think I already gave you this one in the first lecture, where I made the point that pauses actually mean something. Of course it is context dependent. If A says, God, isn't this picture awful, then silence is disagreement. And if A says, I'm getting fat, then silence is agreement. But the important point is that both of these only work because in both cases we have the first part of an adjacency pair. There is the expectation that something should follow. If nothing follows, that is interpreted. Okay, those were preferred and dispreferred responses. Another topic or another concept that you'll need to know about is the concept of repairs. You may have noticed in the conversation that I played you a while ago that there were quite a lot of instances where there were false starts, where there were incomplete sentences, etc. That's not really what I mean with a repair. It's more typically about the content that's being transmitted. For example, she was giving me all the people that were gone this year. I mean, this quarter, you know? Yeah. Okay. This one basically means that they're speaking at the same time. No and yeah overlap. Okay. What happens here? We've got the speaker first saying that all the people that were gone this year, then realizing, no, wait a minute, it wasn't this year, it was only this quarter, I made a mistake, and then corrects him or herself. This is a self-initiated self-repair. The person who utters the mistake, well, the thing that needs to be repaired, finds out him or herself, and then produces what they really wanted to say. This is from the point of view of politeness, and that's one of the reasons why I do this lecture after the pragmatics and politeness lecture, because that makes it better to understand, makes it easier to understand why these things happen. This is, from the point of politeness theory, the most preferred option. Why? Because there is the least face threat involved. Okay. There is some face threat in the sense of that the conversational partner realizes, oh, I made a mistake, but at least I found it out myself and I corrected it immediately. Have a look at sort of the opposite end of the scale. But you know, single beds are awfully thin to sleep on. What? Single beds, you mean narrow? They're awfully narrow, yeah. Okay? Now this is what the conversational analyst would call an other-initiated other repair. So not only does speaker B alert speaker A to the point, you made a boo-boo, okay, you did something that doesn't make sense, but that person also, in addition, provides the correct or the creates the, provides the repair. You can probably see how this is the least preferred option, again from the point of view of face threat. So I've already given you the answer here. Notice also, by the way, that we've got an overlap. We've got two people speaking at the same time. Not very long. Person A stops speaking immediately, doesn't complete the utterance, but we have a certain overlap, and that may be interpreted as an interruption. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about language and identity now, because it has an impact on how conversations proceed and how we interpret what's going on both consciously and unconsciously. I've talked about the concept of face, and that obviously has to do with your identity as a speaker in the community. And we also know already that what you do in conversation may depend on who you talk to. And this is one of the many ways of variation. I also briefly talked about cross-cultural communication before in the written context, but you can imagine, or you can probably imagine yourself, or you have experienced this yourself, that there are also differences in the way conversation might proceed in different cultures. For example, some cultures are much more accepting of pauses. Okay. Finnish speakers, for example, are said to be much happier with longer stretches of silence than other members of, European cultures. Okay. This can lead to potential misunderstandings, because the silence of the Finnish speaker may then be interpreted as having meaning that it certainly doesn't have for the Finnish speaker. And you can then see how dislikes and misconceptions about that person's identity, etc., might arise. So these are actually mechanisms of conversation which may have an immediate impact on how we are thought of in our group, the kind of person we are interpreted to be. Now, I'd like to do a quick excursion into male versus female conversational style. And some of you may know Deborah Tannen and her very popular book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. If you haven't read it, it's a good read. It's got to do with linguistics. It's the sort of popular part of her research. She's also done a lot of more traditional, more linguistic, the kind of research publications. It's been a long week again. Okay. Right, her basic claim is, and I'm being, with what I'm saying over the next few slides, I'm being very black and white here. Okay, so don't take this for the 100% truth. But she basically says that because of the different styles where men and women have in conversation, this is actually a case of cross-cultural communication. Okay. She talks of genderlects. Okay. And she says this is because of the way we've been socialized. Okay. What do girls and boys do? They grow up typically in same-sex groups, play different games, and use a different language. Okay. Use different strategies even from very early on, and socialize within those strategies. Boys tend to play outside in larger groups. All of this, as I said, very black and white. Don't take this too seriously. Okay? There's always a leader present. Okay, in boys' group, people have looked at. Girls play in smaller groups or in pairs, apparently. Okay? The boys tend to give commands without giving reasons. In fact, there might be direct insults. Okay. Why is that so? Because that is intended to signal differences in their status and individual power. Okay. While girls tend to, again, just language-wise, use different strategies. Let's do this. Okay, not you do this, but let's do this. Supporting a common cause. It's more about the power of community and the equal status rather than contest. So, contest versus community is said to be, by Deborah Tannen, the main difference in the two cultures. Okay. And the same situation may actually be therefore differently interpreted by different members of different cultures, men and women. So, aggression and fight would in fact be a way of initiating and facilitating friendship between boys. Disagreement, so to speak, again, very black and white, would therefore be a sign of intimacy between men. While for women and girls, there seems to be a tendency to seek agreement, which is then reflected in their role as peacemakers. So disagreement carries a completely different message. It's a threat to intimacy, so just the opposite. Now, quite a lot of things that I'm saying here are more sort of sociological and general, but the point is that a lot of this happens with language. Part of it, for example, can be explained by looking at what is determined to be a threat. A threat for women in this framework is a conflict in the community. For men, loss of independence. So both parties want to avoid their type of threat. And that then, obviously, you can see, I mean, both want basically to avoid a threat, but it results in the wrong things, right? Misunderstandings and incomprehensions will then therefore occur because those efforts of avoidance are frequently perceived as offensive by women and manipulating by men. It's simply because the focus is different. I see some people nodding their heads, okay? Yeah. There are all sorts of different strategies. How often do men ask for directions? Yeah? Women have no problem doing that. Yeah. Again, black and white, but it's got to do with what is perceived as a threat. Deborah Tannen, I think, she was married to a Greek person, I think, and she's now divorced, and I think much of her experience in that marriage and the breakup, I think, went into that book. I don't know. But anyway, I don't know her personally. If men see life in terms of contest, the struggle against nature and other men, for women, life is a struggle against the danger of being cut off from their community. Yeah? Okay. So we have a contest of popularity versus a contest of skill. This is said to result in different ways of speaking. Deborah Tannen calls it rapport talk versus report talk. So either talk, well, basically I've said everything. I don't need to summarize it anymore. So the main problem between this, well, or not in this cross-cultural situation, is that these things happen unconsciously. In male-female conversation, the main problem is the lack of flexibility. The more a clash of understanding becomes evident, the more both parties insist on their styles, which you can then see obviously makes things worse. Now, if you know about this, Deborah Tannen claims, you might actually make sense of what's going on when you're having problems with your boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife, or maybe just with another conversational counterpart of the opposite sex. It's essential to understand why the partner says something, and not just the content, but perhaps even the how, the way she does or he does, even if one does not see things in the same way. Now, one of these elements of genderlect might be interruptions. What is an interruption? Well, there are different types of definitions. In any case, if there is an interruption, I'll tell you more about what it is in a sec, then you can imagine that this is a, sort of a potentially painful situation in a close relationship. We're interrupting, as it says here, carries a load of meta-message. The department doesn't care enough, doesn't listen, isn't interested, etc. You always talk, you never listen, etc. Those kind of things. But let's have a quick look at what is actually an interruption. One could define interruption acoustically. Two people speak at the same time. One person has the floor, continues talking, and even though there is no transition relevance place, well, let's not even talk about transition relevance places, even though one person hasn't finished talking, the other person starts talking at the same time. That's an interruption, one could say. But is that really necessarily the case? We might also have a look at this acoustic overlap and ask ourselves, what is the effect on the conversation? In fact, conversation can be interrupted without acoustic overlap. This has got to do with the way things are interpreted that happen. Okay. In fact, there might be overlap, but it's not an overlap that is intended to grab the floor, but just basically to be supportive. And women, as we heard, want to be supportive in conversation. This has got to do with issues of dominance. We could call it cooperative overlapping. Cooperative in the sense that the woman, the wife, the girlfriend, or whatever, actually wishes to support their partner by saying something at the same time, not even claiming the floor, really, but it can then perhaps result in misinterpretation if the husband interprets this as something which he, in his culture, is familiar with, namely attempts at being dominant. Women tend to, and that's what's the result of studies of lots of authentic data, be the more cooperative overlappers in the sense that they interrupt in the sense that they produce acoustically overlapping stretches of talk, but it's not meant as grabbing the floor. It's not meant as an example of dominance or as an attempt at dominating the conversation of partner, but of course the man might interpret it like that. Now, as I said, these are sort of black and white things, but I think there might be some truth in this, and it is done via language, via the way we structure conversation. Now, this isn't only about male-female interaction. Deborah Tannen has also looked at different conversational styles depending on what subcultural group you belong to within the United States. She's looked at a dinner conversation where a group of Jewish New Yorkers had a visitor from California. Now, we know Californians are relaxed, right? They're cool, etc. And they're supposed to have a very different conversational style. Now, you probably can't read this in great detail, but, well, actually, you could probably read it. This is basically a conversation between these people. No, what I found were crescent rolls, and all that. Crescent rolls, mostly lots of that kind of stuff. Where? Okay, there's a where here, a question. Croissant. I don't know. I didn't go around a whole lot for breakfast. I was kind of stuck at the plaza for a while, which was interesting. Then it goes on. You live in LA? Yeah. Visiting here? Yeah. What do you know there? I work at Walt Disney. You're an artist? No. Writer? Yeah, I write advertising copy. Now, later, Deborah Tannen spoke to Chad and asked how they had experienced or how he had experienced the conversation. And he said he felt threatened. He felt under pressure. He felt uncomfortable by her constant, Deborah Tannen, questions that were coming in a, what Deborah Tannen calls, machine gun question style. Now, she says, that's just Jewish New Yorker way of communicating. I showed this to Anne-Marie Duplan, who works in our department. I don't know whether you've had contact with her yet. She's from New York, and she's had a lot of contact with Jewish New Yorkers. And she says, yeah, true, yes. And for someone from outside, yeah, now I understand why some people think that I'm like that. She's not herself Jewish, but she's grown up with a lot of contact. And she says, yeah, I can suddenly make sense of why some people might dislike my way of asking questions. So we have very different conversational styles that may result in problems because we are not aware of those differences and therefore misinterpret them. Okay. Another thing that happens quite often, and that is also something that you see in the extract that I played to you, is hesitation markers. That may be realized by way of repetition of certain words, the thing. Those, I think there was one extract quickly at some stage in the talk. Or we might have filled pauses. These kind of features are extremely frequent in spoken interaction. Why? Well, there could be simply hesitation proper. I don't know what to say next. But it could also be a signpost for I'm happy to yield my term. So it could be interpreted as a transition relevance place. What shall we talk about? Well, I wanted to talk about the hostages. Oh yes, and then the person goes on. Yeah. So it's almost an invitation for the conversational partner to take the, or to self-select, so 1B. It can also be used to highlight infrequent words for 6 hours after the aromatherapy. Now this may be because the speaker may want to remember the exact word, but it may also simply apparently be a way of signaling a difficult word is coming. We seem to use these hesitation markers to signal what's going on in our brain. Okay. And they frequently occur at syntactic boundaries. I'll come back to that point in the next lecture. There's actually disagreement among linguists whether these are words or not, and things like that. Okay, but it's not necessary to go into greater detail here. Now, obviously, a lot of what goes on in conversation is dependent on the way I move, on my gestures, etc., the gaze, body language, etc. But it is possible to do all the things that I've talked about so far without seeing each other. We do this all the time on the phone. Okay. There you simply cannot rely on these clues for turn-taking. So it must be purely language internal then. I'd like to look at those five... Oh, sorry, that was a bit fast. Ha. Come on, okay. Those 4 points. Openings of conversations on the phone, the choice of topic, change of topic, and then closing sequences. Closing sequences are particularly interesting. What happens at the beginning of a phone call? Okay, this is slightly outdated because, well, up until recently you couldn't see who was calling. Okay, well, not that recently, but I can still remember that. So C causes telephone to ring at R's place. R picks up and says, hello, hi, oh, hi. Okay. And the first hello is, in a way, not the first turn in this interaction. It's the second part of an adjacency pair. Now, today, of course, we see who's calling, and the situation is slightly different. Who decides about the topic? The caller or the person who is being called? Hello? Hello, Rob. This is Laurie. How's everything? Pretty good. How about you? Just fine. The reason I called was to ask, etc. That seems to be the common, a very common way of starting a phone conversation, and any deviation from this would then be rather marked. It is possible, but that's then not necessarily the norm, and the speaker might actually be slightly taken aback. Okay, so the person who calls is expected to start a topic. How do you change a topic on the phone? Here's a typical example. It's okay, we'll pop down tomorrow, Gertrude. You sure you don't? It's an awful lot of it, you know. You quickly want to nip down now for it? Okay, I will. Hey, you, that is, have you been lighting a fire down there? Okay. Now, you would really have to listen to this. I can't do this very well. But she is changing the topic here. She wants to ask a different question, or it's going. She's talking about a different aspect. And she signals this in various ways. People have noticed that the pitch, or not the pitch, but the loudness increases in the context of topic changes. Also, the pitch is raised. Okay? So the voice becomes higher. Okay? You also have some markers of self-editing, like hesitation markers, and this marker of discontinuity, hey. Okay. And that seems to help speakers to realize, oh, okay, it's a new topic. Okay, let's move over to the most interesting one for me. How do you close a conversation on the phone? This is a potentially face-threatening act. Because if you close a phone conversation too soon, too quickly, then you may signal to the other person that something will have gone wrong. Try to do this one, just sort of say, oh yeah, okay, bye. Your conversational partner will think something has gone wrong. Okay. So, let's have a look at this. Now, this will sound terribly artificial, but this is a transcription from a real ending. Why don't we all have lunch? Okay, so that would be in St. Jude's, would it? Yes. Okay, so, 1 o'clock in the bar, okay. Okay? Okay then, thanks very much indeed, George. All right, see you there. Okay, bye, okay? I mean, I'm overdoing this here, but there is a lot going on. Because both speakers want to make sure that they're stopping at exactly the right time. If it's over hasty, it's a problem. If it's over slow, it's a problem. Because they will then carry unwelcome inferences about the social relationship. Again, cultures might differ there. My PhD supervisor is a Swedish woman. And I'm still not entirely sure whether it's Swedish in terms of Swedish culture or sort of nation, or whether it's just her. I don't know. But she has this habit of finishing off conversations over the phone or Skype very, very abruptly. So she just basically, when we've said enough, she says, okay, good, bye, and then she sort of hangs it up. And it took me a very long time to realize that it's not because I didn't make her happy with what I said or didn't provide what she wanted, etc. I was working as an assistant for her. So it seems to be, well, either idiosyncratic, as it might be as well, or it seems to be definitely culture specific. Again, misinterpretation or miscommunication can occur. And, as I said before, non-communication is not as bad as miscommunication. I used to live in Switzerland. The Swiss always thank each other for calling. Okay. You can do that in German too, but not to the extent that the Swiss are doing it. There will always be a slot at some stage, even if it's the person who actually didn't want something from you, but it's the other way around. That person that... you call that person... No, anyway, you know what I mean. It's if that person wanted something from you, but will then say, thank you for calling. Okay? And I once tried, a couple of times, to not say that in the appropriate slot, and a couple of times my conversational counterpart said, thank you too. Yeah, but I hadn't even thanked that person. So it seems to be so conventionalized that it's part of the closing sequence in Swiss phone calls, that when you don't do it, the speaker feels the need to complete the adjacency pair which was never opened. Okay, I'd like to now play the extract again, and I'd like you to listen to the kind of things that I mentioned. I'd like you to listen to repairs. I'd like you to listen to, well, everything I said, basically. Male versus female conversation, perhaps, and a few other aspects. I'll play it once, and then I'll just ask for one or two pieces of feedback from you to see whether you've noticed anything in particular. And as I said before, listen again where these back channels happen, the mms and mhm. It's quite interesting how they tend to appear rhythmically just in a place where there is a minor acoustic pause, but it's not actually a pause in the sense of a real pause where nothing is said. Okay, have a listen.
And so, channel crossing.
So it was lovely hour one with the nightclub, and we had a super cabin which was just below the nightclub. Utterly soundproof. You know, when you think what ours is like, when we shut our cabin door, even though there was anything outside, there was a nightclub, pounding music away, just one immediately overhead, and we were a cabin next to it. And we couldn't hear at all. And of course we could say to the children, we'd just be upstairs, and then they just have to put their dressing gown on and come up if they wanted it. So that was super.
Wait, did you have a cow with you?
Mm-hmm. It's all included in the price.
Yes, you.
Oh,
how did you get? I mean, how did you find that side of it? Because,
Martin.
You know, some people say that the drowning cloud across the ferry is in the devil of a job.
Well,
it's not. I mean, taking the cloud across to the continent.
No,
on the ferry, it's hell.
No, it isn't at all.
I mean, across the channel. You go to, well, if you want, if you've got a cabin, if it's a night, this crossing, you automatically have a cabin. But on the cross channel, you don't. But if it's a day one, you can have a day cabin, you can put in a couple of hours, and it's probably worth it for the kids. Mm. And you just go, it's like,
well, I think that's all the matter. I mean, every summer, you see stories of tremendous queues.
But then you go and booked.
Yeah. I keep going.
Mind you, last summer, the weekend, where the queues were so bad,
okay. Did anyone find any repairs? Yeah. Yes, okay, yes. That would be, what is it? Is it a self-initiated self? Yeah. It's an other repair. Is it an other initiated or is it a self-initiated? In a way, she is signaling that she doesn't quite know, right? I think it's a she, yeah. And sort of invites the other person to provide the correct response by her hesitation marker, isn't it? So in that sense, she is showing her willingness to be corrected. So this would be an example of a self-initiated other repair. Yeah? Okay. There is one other initiated other repair in there, which is quite obvious. Has anyone found that? Mm-hmm. No. It's not the one I mean, no. There's something. Yeah?
I think you mean in line 27, when C says, Camille taking a car across the continent.
Yes.
And then he
Yeah, exactly. Across the channel, is that what you mean? I think the person even says, yeah. So a couple, and there is some kind of, there is also what or what. There are signals that the conversational partner doesn't quite understand what the person means, but that could be interpreted as a suggestion to self-repair. It would then be an other-initiated self-repair if speaker A had said, "Oh, I mean across the channel," but that doesn't happen, and in fact the repair is offered by the other person who says, "Across the channel, is that what you mean?" And then the person said, yeah, that's what I mean. Okay, which is an example of an other-initiated, other repair, and it's the least preferred and the most potentially face-threatening option. Okay? Yes, good. Okay, and there are many other instances one could talk about. I think there is one interruption or one clear instance of where she is taking on the floor not brutally, but she becomes very loud, but certainly in whatever, then until she gets the floor and she wins that floor. Okay. There are also a lot of false starts, there are hesitation markers, etc. We could look at this in much more detail, but I think it's time for a summary. We've looked at the turn-taking rules. We looked at adjacency pairs. These are features that you need to know and find in the text. I mentioned the communicative impact of pauses, and I linked this up to the concept of adjacency pairs. I introduced preferred and dispreferred responses, which you need to be able to detect or to know their impact on possible future parts in the conversation. I talked in a very black and white way about differences in conversational styles, particularly between men and women. I made the point that an interruption may be different from an acoustic overlap because there may be cooperative overlappers, namely women, that then are seen to be interrupters by men because of their different outlook on life, according to Deborah Tannen. And I quickly looked at phone conversations, and I did this in order to make the point that this is proof of the fact that these mechanisms work language internally and do not rely on extra-linguistic factors or things like gestures, body language of all sorts, gaze, etc. Next week is the lecture on corpus linguistics, which traditionally is a lecture that a lot of people either don't like or like most. Okay, so it polarizes quite a lot. I'm doing this because it is a methodology, it is a way of doing linguistics, which we do quite a lot here in the department. It's a way of looking at language data, of a lot of language data, of a lot of authentic language data, which we think is a useful way of doing when you want to find out how language is used and how it works. I've just uploaded a reading. That's a chapter from a book on a particular tool. It gives you a brief introduction to what a corpus is. Please read it before next week. And see you next week for the last lecture.